as well as any father can be on the day his son is buried. Jim Jensen reporting from Hyannis.
Ladies and gentlemen, in Washington at the scene of the funeral today, they are now beginning taking up the program that had been originally planned much earlier, and the first official act in that program was a reception in the White House given by Mrs. Kennedy for all of the dignitaries who came so far from their homes a long way off to pay their tribute to the late president. And now they are arriving at the White House. We switch you to Senator Van Oker at the White House. By Secretary of State Dean Rusk's protocol officials, dignitaries from faraway Africa, white robed in black trimming.
Africa, Asia, Europe.
I believe that was the Nigerian delegation.
And they're arriving one by one, slowly, moving in to the East Room of the White House, where Mrs. Kennedy will officiate and personally thank each one of them. As you may have heard, she's already had a brief conversation with de Gaulle. And just passing in at this time is the Indonesian delegation. It came all the way from Jakarta, far across the Pacific, to be here. Indonesia is the site, as we told you a few moments ago, where the Red Chinese refused to lower their flag to half-staff in honor of the late president. In front, the cars are being expedited by the White House police, sort of a gentle manner. There'll be some time now before the reception is completed. And we turn our attention to other important matters. Later on this afternoon in Washington, there will be a special meeting with President Johnson and all of the visiting delegations in Washington. Everything seems to be going smoothly. Many of you know there have been tributes in many lands to the late President Kennedy. Perhaps unique among all the tributes came from London, from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. They, during the weekend, changed the format of a political satirical program and gave instead a tribute to Mr. Kennedy. And in a very short time, we will be able to give you that program. For the moment, let us note that President Charles de Gaulle is returning at once to France, and it is rather significant that Paris reports to us now that almost immediately on his return, the French president will be asked to consider the possibility of a successor to himself. As you know, he is chief of state and also the head of government of France. He is the only official of a foreign government attending the funeral of President Kennedy. He was both chief of state and the head of government. Usually they have presidents and premiers. The premier is the head of the government. The presidents are chief of state. President de Gaulle, under the Fifth Republic, is both, and therefore he will be asked when he returns to France to consider the possibility of a successor to himself when he returns. And the suggested change will be a format similar to the Vice Presidency of the United States. He may or may not act on that right away. He has been quoted in various ways at various times as indicating that at his age of 76, he is concerned about succession. He's been the target of several assassination attempts. He has always stubbornly resisted the idea of a vice president, however, in the past. One time he asked, what would we do with such a man? If we set him up in the palace, people will call him a parasite. If he stays at home, he will not be preparing himself for the tasks he might have to assume. But the shock of events in the United States in the last 3 days may make it necessary for the president of France to change his mind about these things. As we told you a few moments ago, the British political satirists on the BBC changed the entire format of their program. No satire, total and solemn tribute to John Fitzgerald Kennedy. The program's name is That Was the Week That Was. It was given last Saturday night. And because it is possibly among the most impressive tributes that have been paid to our president, we would like to repeat it now. The BBC's That Was the Week That Was.
The reason why the shock was so great, why when one heard the news last night, one felt suddenly so empty, was because it was the most unexpected piece of news one could possibly imagine. It was the least likely thing to happen in the whole world. If anyone else had died, Sir Winston Churchill, de Gaulle, Khrushchev, would have been something that somehow we could have understood and even perhaps accepted. But that Kennedy should go, well, we just didn't believe in assassination anymore. Not in the civilized world, anyway.
When Kennedy was elected 3 years ago, it was as if we'd all been given some gigantic, miraculous present. Suddenly, over there in Washington, was this amazing man who seemed so utterly right for the job in every way that we took him completely for granted. Whenever we thought about the world, we had that warm image at the back of our minds of a man who would keep everything on the rails. Now suddenly that present has been taken away from us when we thought we had still 5 more years before we need to start worrying again.
It's funny how people used to talk about Eisenhower as a father figure. Kennedy was far more of a father figure and much more than Ike ever was.
One just cannot believe that, well, that rich, happy, talented family could have so much bad luck. Brother Joe was killed in the war. Sister Rosemary born a mental defective. And Sister Kathleen dead in an air crash. When Jack Kennedy visited Europe this year, after his visit to Ireland, he came to Britain and he flew to Chatsworth in Derbyshire to visit the grave, his sister's grave. Well, when he got there, there were more than 200 security officers all around this little churchyard. And right next to her was buried, her husband was buried there also, who died in the war. And there were hundreds of other policemen guarding hundreds of yards of ground in this little churchyard. And about 20 feet away from the grave, there was a team of medical men with blood plasma just in case anything would happen. Well, it didn't happen in that little churchyard. But in a city like Dallas, thousands of people crowding the streets, it happened. And there wasn't anything that anybody could do about it.
When the news came through just before 8 o'clock last night, more than 1,000 people all over London caught buses or tube trains, took taxis, drove or walked to the American Embassy in Grosvenor Square. They had to do something. In Berlin, Mayor Willy Brandt asked people to put lighted candles in their darkened windows. Within minutes, they were flickering out all over the city. In Moscow at 8:05, the radio broke into its programs to announce the news. It was followed by solemn organ music. In London, viewers reacted with equal hostility to being treated to a half hour of comedy or being deprived of 20 minutes of soap opera.
Well, when Kennedy was picked to be Democratic candidate for the presidency in 1960, Norman Mailer wrote a piece about him in Esquire called Superman Comes to Supermart. At that time, of course, the sort of general opinion was that Kennedy was too perfect, too good to be true. So PRO's ideal American. He had all the sort of film star image, the beautiful wife, the great speeches with easy quotations from Burke and Shakespeare, the ice-cold efficiency, respect for the facts. But there was the homely, all-American humanity of the man, who, when his head went out in his family boating picnics, and his wife was down one end of the boat eating the pâté de foie gras, he could be sitting quite happily in the bow, knocking back the peanut butter sandwiches.
But once Kennedy was in office, the dream came true. Behind the rocking chair and the cultural evenings at the White House and Caroline's pony and the parties in Bobby's swimming pool, behind the trappings of the image, was the first Western politician to make politics a respectable profession for 30 years. To make it once again the highest of the professions and not just a fabric of fraud and sham. When most statesmen die, they have to be explained away with words like integrity and cunning and courage. But Kennedy did not need such apologies, for he was simply and superlatively a man of his age, who understood his age, who put all his own energy and the best brains of his country into solving its problems, and who ended up, in more cases than not, by doing the right thing at the right time, because he'd gone about it in the right way.
Few people would have thought at the beginning of this year that by its end we would have lost the leader of the opposition in Britain, Pope John in Rome, and the President of the United States. We have been very aware of death this year. Even here in this studio, we have lost someone we still miss. But with the murder of John Kennedy, death has become immediate to people all over the world. For the first time, because of the stature of the man and the nature of a shrinking world, people everywhere feel they've lost someone they'll miss. Yesterday, one man died. Today, in America, 60 lost their lives in a fire. And yet, somehow, it is the one that matters. Even in death, it seems, we're not equal. Death is not the great leveler. Death reveals the eminent.
A young man rode with his head held high under the Texas sun, and no one guessed that a man so blessed would perish by the gun. Lord, would perish by the gun. The shot rang out like a sudden shout, and heaven held its breath. For the dreams of a multitude of men rode with him to his death. Lord, rode with him to his death. Yes, the heart of the world waved.
There has been today one ominous hint of future developments. Already the assassination, which seems at the moment at any rate to have been the action of an individual, is being made subject to the first manipulations of various groups and sections of opinion for their own ends. In America and even here, they have already begun to show their hand. It would be good to hope that the death of a great man will not become a pawn in a power struggle of one sort or another. But it would, alas, be naive.
There are two men in the world, for the first time since the world began, in whose hands there lies the possibility of bringing all life on this globe to an end and making its charred remains uninhabitable to the end of time. One of those men looks out on the loneliest view in the world, the view from the White House windows in the middle of our bitter and war-torn century. And yet how little true it is that all power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It would be closer to the truth to say that such power transforms, elevates, even purifies its holder. That the assumption of so terrible a burden, even as it marks out its bearer as a man forever apart, at the same time gives him the strength to lift it. In what manner this man, whose identity is less important than his office, has come, by degrees, to bear the burden of hundreds of millions who know nothing of him, is no longer important, even if it could be determined. What matters now is that we recognize what we have done. The loneliness of power is a universally accepted truth. There remains the recognition of the loneliness of absolute power, the responsibility for all life and death, a responsibility hitherto reserved only to God. In a sense so terribly real that it transcends paradox, mankind has, by a conscious decision, appointed for itself a God substitute. And the blasphemy of the appointment by men of one man to live and die for us all is rooted in the ultimate blasphemy of the world that it made it necessary. And so, once again, we are reminded that no man is an island. And the bell that tolls in Dallas tolls for us all. Not only because of our inextricable interdependence, not only because it shows that although it may be expedient that one man should die for the people, it is neither wise nor just. Not only because it teaches us all that we cannot slough off our responsibilities by putting them all onto one elected scapegoat, but above all because, as the bell tolls, it reminds us, in the hideous emphasis it places upon the reality of power, of the frailty of the body in which that power must ultimately rest. And in doing so, prompts us to remember with Montaigne, that sit we never so high on a stool, yet sit we but upon our own tails.
To Jackie. Yesterday, the sun was shot out of your sky, Jackie. Why, Jackie? A man who was able and hopeful and gay was called abruptly from this world's day, his journey done, his song half sung. Why, Jackie, why? What can we say to you, we who all pray with you, widow and mother? We who know well the peace-loving world lost a friend and a brother. His sun has set, but we do not forget you, our sister. Yours, the hard part. May God give you good heart, little sister.
Amid the echoes of what was, with the exception of the one that killed the Archduke Ferdinand at Sarajevo, the loudest shot the world has ever heard, one bitterly ironic coincidence has gone unnoticed. A few hours before he died, President Kennedy had taken time out of his crowded program to look in on the birthday celebrations in Dallas of John Nance Garner. Garner, who was 95 yesterday, was Roosevelt's first vice president and is by far the senior of the surviving former holders of that office. And when at the 1960 Democrat convention in Los Angeles, Lyndon Johnson, defeated by Kennedy for the presidential nomination, was offered the vice presidency, he hesitated. To help him make up his mind, he telephoned his fellow Texan, Garner, who had held the post all those years before, to ask whether he would advise acceptance. No, said Garner, he would not. And in a typically Texan phrase, added, Lyndon, the vice presidency isn't worth a pitcher of warm spit. Nevertheless, Johnson accepted Kennedy's offer, and in consequence became yesterday evening the 35th president of the United States. The succession was immediate. In the world of today, neither grief nor shock can be permitted to create an interregnum in the citadels of power. The president is dead. Long live the president. And such is the pace at which the modern world moves, that even before the morning is over, indeed even before it has begun, we must begin to think not of the past, but of the future. What then can be read of the future with President Johnson? For the time has long since gone by when the responsibility of the President of the United States was confined to the people of that country alone. I believe that this now global responsibility has fallen into good hands. The contrasts between President Johnson and his predecessor are more obvious than important. Johnson, unlike Kennedy, is not an intellectual, but then neither was Truman. Johnson is provincial where Kennedy was metropolitan, but his years as leader of the Senate gave him a knowledge, understanding, and control of the realities of power in politics almost as sophisticated as that of Roosevelt. Johnson, in the inevitable isolation of the vice presidency, had had no direct power to exercise. Yet Kennedy, unlike Roosevelt, took his deputy fully into his confidence and shared with him the results of his decisions, if not their making. Johnson's health is suspect. So was Roosevelt's. So was Eisenhower's. And so indeed was Kennedy's own. And President Johnson will bring to the awful responsibility of his office qualities and a record that offer promise that he will be more than merely the best available shadow of the light that failed. Though a Southerner, his record on the color question, the rock on which America's future must either be built or sink, is one of the best in the Democrat Party. It was he who steered through Congress the only successful civil rights legislation of recent years. And during the 1960 election, he and his wife faced physical violence in their home state for his liberal stand. The other major domestic political achievement of his career, though here too the impossibility of considering its effect only on the United States is apparent, was the planning and execution of the strategy that finally destroyed Senator McCarthy. There is every reason to believe that the assumption of supreme office will only confirm in President Johnson and his policies the beliefs that informed these actions and attitudes. Abroad, he will be chiefly remembered for his dash to Berlin during the crisis of the building of the wall. He was then much criticized for his extrovert behavior, but no part of that criticism came from the Berliners, who correctly saw in his visit a symbol of America's determination to stand firm in the face of any threat to freedom. Nor, on the other hand, is there any reason to fear that the thaw in the frozen attitudes of East-West relations will be seriously endangered, let alone reversed, by President Johnson's accession. His incomparable political shrewdness, the clarity and firmness of the lines which President Kennedy had drawn on the charts of policy into the future, the team of younger men that he has inherited, these will combine to ensure continuity in those aspects of American policy which are of such direct concern to us all. And the ambassadorial mission he undertook for the then fledgling president a few weeks after Kennedy had been elected took him through Western Europe, including Britain, and wherever he went, he made a good impression which will stand him in good stead now. And it's significant that that mission was carried out in the company of so liberal and devotedly internationalist an American figure as Senator Fulbright. Nobody tonight can wish more fervently than President Johnson himself that this dreadful opportunity had not fallen upon him. But since it has, we, citizens of the alliance he now leads, have the right to hope for much from his leadership and the duty to wish him well with all our hearts. I think those hopes and wishes will not be disappointed. A poet once hymned an earlier, narrower moment of crisis in the life of the United States. How much more bitterly relevant are Longfellow's words today. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging on thy fate.
The tragedy of John Kennedy's death is not that the liberal movements of history that he led will cease. It is that their focus may become blurred and that the gathering momentum may be lost. That is the aftermath of Dallas, November 22. It is a time for private thoughts. Good night.
And now for the events in Washington following the funeral of the president, we switch you to Russ Ward in Washington.
Morgan, the story here right now is one of a diplomatic reception at the White House. Scores, actually hundreds of diplomats arriving one at a time, two, three, four in groups, limousines pulling up continually at the executive mansion. The greeter on the north portico, William Tonnes, the deputy chief of protocol at the State Department, shaking hands. Occasionally the diplomats arriving, wiping tears from their eyes, still overcome with grief from the assassination on Friday and the dramatic funeral procession that occurred earlier this afternoon. It's still quiet here. I flew down from New York earlier this afternoon, and the plane actually flew over Arlington National Cemetery, where the funeral took place. You could, even from an altitude of perhaps 5,000 feet, you could look down and see the ribbons of black lining Memorial Bridge. Of course, the ribbons being spectators waiting, standing quietly, watching as the funeral procession was to come by a few moments later. The plane landed, and I drove up what many of our listeners, I'm sure, know as a beautiful drive along the Potomac River, the Mount Vernon Memorial Parkway. And all along the parkway, on both sides, cars parked 5-6 deep, people who had left their cars there early this morning to walk, perhaps half a mile up to Memorial Bridge. The Arlington National Cemetery, of course, was closed to the public. But these people, wanting to get a final glimpse of the funeral procession. It was a thoroughly touching moment, and I couldn't help but feel at the time, as I joined the crowd going toward Memorial Bridge, that we've seen another day of history made, but it'll be a long time before we forget it. More on that diplomatic reception now that's going on at the Executive Mansion. Here's Richard Harkness at the White House.
Well, Mrs. Kennedy came back rapidly from Arlington National Cemetery as soon as the services were over there and returned to the White House proper. Russ, you just referred to this as a reception at the White House. I believe this is a very small difference. I think it might be more proper to say that she is now receiving the heads of state and foreign dignitaries who came as far away as 8,000 miles around the world to pay homage and respect to her late husband. As the widow of the former president, it was incumbent upon her to receive these men and ladies from around the world and thank them for the tribute that they have paid to their husband. As all of us know so well, the cortege, the funeral procession to Arlington National Cemetery went at a slow and measured pace. However, the District of Columbia Police, plus armed forces who were stationed at, I would, every 8 to 10 feet along the route, remained, kept those streets clear, and the cars came back as rapidly as 40, 50, or even 60 miles an hour to the White House. Mrs. Kennedy went in by the what is technically the front, which is the private entrance, that's the White House, the one facing the mall, and then the heads of state and dignitaries used the rear entrance, which is that along the White along Pennsylvania Avenue under the portico, which all of us know so well. The first to arrive was Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. Then, in rapid fire order, there was Le General Charles de Gaulle, the President of France, the President of West Germany, Heinrich Lübke, then Prince Philip of Great Britain with the Prime Minister of Great Britain and with Mr. Harold Wilson, the head of the opposition Labour Party, President De Valera of Ireland, a close friend, of course, of Mrs. Kennedy's late husband, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, Crown Prince Harald of Norway, Prince Bertil of Sweden, and from the USSR, the Soviet Union, Anastas Mikoyan, who was accompanied by the Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko. While I've been hastily going through my notes, Richard Valeriani of NBC News also was under the portico. Dick?
The first deputy premier of the Soviet Union, Anastas Mikoyan, entered not too long ago. It was curious to note that the limousines that are bringing the heads of state and the other dignitaries up to the north portico of the White House all bear a placard identifying the country from which they come. The Soviet limousine did not have a placard. It was flanked by four Soviet Secret Service agents and by two American Secret Service agents who then entered the White House by a side entrance. The dignitaries are being greeted on the steps by Mr. William Tonisk, the Deputy Chief of Protocol in the Department of State. The dress, of course, as it was at the funeral, is mourning coats. However, there are Africans who are arriving in their ceremonial robes and Asians in full military dress. So an Indonesian woman in a sari. And they're still coming up. The portico is draped in black bunting and mourning, of course. Lieutenant the Secretary General of the United Nations is there, as you mentioned, along with Ralph Bunch, the Undersecretary, and the cars are still pulling up.
Yes, each gentleman or lady is staying only a brief time. This is not a party in any sense of the word. It is merely a bit of necessary diplomatic protocol, and it does place undoubtedly an extra strain upon Mrs. Kennedy, but that is one of the duties, the heavy responsibilities, if you please, of being in office, the White House or the presidential palace or the seat of power of any country. Incidentally, the office of the White House news secretary, Pierre Salinger, has told us just a few moments ago that Mr. Salinger will hold a news briefing sometime between 5 and 6 o'clock this afternoon. We do not know as yet what subject matter will be, but it undoubtedly will be some important news. That brings us up to date at the White House. This is Richard Harkness with Richard Valeriani of NBC News.
Republican Senator Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania today proposed a temporary suspension on political speeches. This to spare the new president, Lyndon Johnson, the need to divert his attention from matters of national security. Senator Scott's proposal was contained in a letter to Massachusetts Senator Leverett Saltonstall, the chairman of the Senate Republican Conference. Scott says he made the proposal after conferring with other Republicans, including Barry Goldwater and Thurston Moorton. In his proposal, Senator Scott also said that all presently scheduled political speeches around the country should be canceled. All of this giving us an indication of the bipartisanship displayed on Capitol Hill right now of what has taken place since shortly after noon on Friday. It certainly would not seem appropriate to get into a political wrangle this quickly after the president's burial. Certainly this does not mean that politics will stop on Capitol Hill or anywhere else. It, as Senator Scott suggests, it means a temporary suspension at least. Tomorrow, the new president, Lyndon Johnson, to hold numerous conferences with many of these foreign dignitaries who are now in Washington and who are paying their respects to the First Family. And then on Wednesday, President Johnson will address a joint session of Congress. This to be a major foreign policy address, as we understand it. Presumably, it will be used to reassure our allies abroad that because of the passing of one president and the succession of another has taken place, this does not mean that there's going to be a breakdown in U.S. policies abroad. I would gather from what many of our correspondents from overseas have reported, there is a certain amount of concern on the part of the West Berliners, for example, that perhaps the new President Johnson will not be as firm in his determination for freedom for West Berlin as President Kennedy obviously was. This, I would think, is an unwarranted fear on the part of the West Berliners because Johnson certainly has been echoing the foreign policy commitments of President Kennedy, and there's no reason to believe there's going to be any change now. At any rate, we're going to see a lot of and hear a lot of foreign policy discussed in the next 2 days, primarily because of the national leaders who are here in Washington. Mayor Brandt of Berlin, Sir Alec Douglas Hume, President de Gaulle, and so many others. We'll hear a lot about this tomorrow as Lyndon Johnson confers with these leaders, and we'll, the public, of course, will hear about it Wednesday when the new president goes before a joint session of Congress. Let's go back to New York now and to Morgan Beatty.
And from Moscow, we get indications and confirmation of the things you've just been saying, Russ, about foreign policy. The Soviet government has released the first most important message that President Johnson has sent to a foreign leader, Premier Nikita Khrushchev. That message affirms the policies of President Kennedy toward world peace, confirms that he will continue. He uses the word continue several times, and it is significant that it was not released in Washington. It was released in Moscow. So that we now have the prospect that the new president, in his exchange of messages in this period of mourning, will actually and very delicately begin to convey to all of them a continuity of policy, certainly for the foreseeable future. And now I think it is only fitting that we note at this time that the Kennedy children played a very sad part in today's events, but because this was an adult occasion, a funeral of their father, they were more or less left out. At least the coverage of what they did and how things developed with them was not as prominent as it might have been. They were taken to the Capitol today by their mother. It was her third visit before the bier of her husband this morning, and they saw the coffin there for the last time before the funeral ceremony. And then, after that, they were taken by car back to the White House with her, but they did not join in the walking procession to St. Matthew's Cathedral. They were taken by car there, and there they met their mother. Little John, who was 3 years old today, his birthday, had a book in his hand, and as his father's coffin passed by, his mother took the book from him, and he saluted the casket. Both children were well composed at this stage. And they passed on inside. Their mother maintained her composure, the same composure she has maintained from the moment of the death of her husband until the exit from St. Matthew's Cathedral. And then something else happened. We'll be back in a moment.
NBC continues its coverage of the events surrounding the death of the late President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
And we were in the midst of the story of John John, as he's known, the 3-year-old son of the president, and Caroline, who will be 6 years old on Wednesday, the story of their day when their father was laid to rest. We had got up to the going in at St. Matthew's Cathedral. John John was a little bit fidgety during the ceremony. He seemed somewhat, perhaps dimly, able to understand the tragedy of the event at that time. Caroline controlled herself, as did her mother. But upon leaving the low pontifical mass, Cardinal Cushing bent over and kissed Caroline and gave her a half smile. And then, nobody knows exactly how this happened, but all of a sudden, as they were leaving St. Matthew's, Caroline began crying inconsolably as she followed her father's casket en route to Arlington Cemetery. It is perhaps at that moment, her daughter's grief, that led Jacqueline Kennedy to temporarily lose her composure. She bent forward as though in pain, and she sobbed into her handkerchief. And then John Jr. broke into cries within the cathedral, and then Mrs. Kennedy suddenly pulled herself back together again and soothed John Jr. and Caroline, and they undertook the final vigil of death. It may have been that Mrs. Kennedy's marriage had impressed her during the funeral ceremony, because Luigi Vena, a Boston tenor who had sung at the Kennedy wedding, I believe it was 11 years ago, had come to Washington to sing at his funeral the Ave Maria. We will never know until perhaps some time has elapsed and Mrs. Kennedy is able to tell us some of her private thoughts, exactly what happened to break her. But it is certainly clear that this First Lady of the land had held herself together magnificently for 3 long days. She had seen her husband fall. She cradled his head in her arm in Dallas, Texas, on the way to the hospital. She stood in the hospital room, refused to leave when the physicians felt they might have to operate, and she saw everything that happened there with her stockings soaked with her husband's blood. And then she went with him to the airport, or at the same time she was taken to the airport in Dallas, and watched his successor sworn in as president. All through, she maintained composure, and when she returned to Washington, and then again last night, she was totally composed when she asked her brother-in-law, Robert Kennedy, to take her up to the Capitol, almost in the middle of the night. And for the second time, she kissed the flag on her funeral's bier. This morning, when she went there with her children, she merely knelt in front of the bier. She did not kiss the flag. And so we have the story of 2 little children, one of whom seems to be definitely aware of all that is going on around her, Caroline. She's 6 years old, and all of this will be indelibly carried into her life ahead. But when you think of little John John, 3 years old, you wonder about it. Can you think of yourself at the age of 3? I have looked back and tried in my own lifetime to see whether or not there was any little dim prescience of events around me, and I seem to recall 1 or 2 things that my parents have told me about. It would be very important if John John should remember some of what happened, because one day he will be able to show the world something. The first handwritten letter, written by his father's successor, Lyndon Johnson, written in Dallas on the airplane before he went to Washington, the first letter John John has gotten from the new president came from Lyndon Johnson, and he wrote another one to Caroline. They will not be made public. They're personal.
The NBC Radio Network continues to bring you uninterrupted coverage on this, the third day of mourning following the death of the late President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. We now pause 10 seconds for station identification.
WNBC, AM and FM, New York. The time, 4:30.
Not too long ago, we were telling you about the tributes that have been paid in foreign lands to the president since he died on Friday. And we repeated for you the tribute of the British BBC. It may not be in keeping with the program pace and mood that many Americans know, but undoubtedly through it shown for you the deep sincerity of feeling in the loss in Britain. And today, these tributes continued, as we've reported, but perhaps most important is the attentive interest of Europeans in the funeral ceremony. Millions on millions of European television viewers on both sides of the Iron Curtain watched the funeral of President Kennedy. It was relayed by a communications satellite from Washington, and of course the satellite is limited as to the amount of time it has to be, the broadcasting has to be done against the satellite when it is passing over a given point, and it's limited, and so the picture that was carried into Europe covered part of the procession down Pennsylvania Avenue, and the stop at the White House for the procession to dismount from cars and go afoot to St. Matthew's Cathedral. The picture ended, it seemed, at a peroration point with the body entering St. Matthew's Cathedral for the funeral. The Moscow television and radio carried the funeral ceremony. They preceded it with pictures of the late president addressing an election campaign meeting in Los Angeles in 1960. They also showed a meeting between President Kennedy and the Russian Premier Nikita Khrushchev in 1961. That's where these men took their first measure of each other. And that's where, when Nikita Khrushchev showed determination, that President Kennedy told him it's going to be a cold, long winter. And it was quite that much more than a cold, long winter. It was several cold, long winters, and may still be more. But nevertheless, the Russians did show the procession today, and their commentary, the principal commentator of Soviet Russia, Yuri Fokin, was the man who made the commentary with it. And if we may repeat again what he said, the grief of the Soviet people mingles with the grief of the American people. And the entire broadcast was in that mood. Millions of West Germans also witnessed the Washington ceremony on their television sets. And in Switzerland, virtually all work stopped. People crowded around their TV sets to see the president's coffin being borne through the cold, clear air of the United States Capitol. The reception of the picture and all of the voice with it was perfect. It was a 30-minute transition, and it was heard in Sweden and Belgium, and in Yugoslavia, it was heard in Czechoslovakia, in Prague. The Czech shows that nearly 1.5 million in that communist state tuned in the live transmission from Washington covering the death of our president. The world's interest surpasses any interest in the death of an American chief executive, even that of President Roosevelt, because the world has come much closer together then, unquestionably. Britain at that time was very sensitive to the death of Roosevelt when he died at the end of World War II, but many other nations were not very sensitive. Since then, they have learned to look upon us as the world's leader, and they've learned to think very much about the man who leads, the President of the United States.
And there was a particular tribute in the Middle East. We take you now to Alvin Rosenfeld in Jerusalem.
The people and government of Israel honor the memory of John F. Kennedy tonight with a special synagogue service here in Jerusalem. The central synagogue was filled with members of Israel's cabinet and parliament, diplomats, churchmen of every faith, and ordinary Israelis come to pray in Kennedy's memory. The service was simple and brief but moving. It began with the lighting of memorial candles by Israel's acting president and by American Ambassador Walworth Barber, candles lit in several candlesticks before the Holy Ark. Then the cantor chanted the terribly appropriate words of Psalm 64. Hear my voice, O God. Preserve my life from the dread of the enemy. Hide me from the secret plots of the wicked, from the scheming of evildoers, who whet their tongues like swords, who aim bitter words like arrows, shooting from ambush at the blameless, shooting at him suddenly and without fear. Then the chief rabbi of Israel, Rishon Letzion HaRav Yitzchak Nissim, spoke at this state memorial service in Jerusalem.
Mityasibim anu ata b'makom kadosh ze lemalei chuba nisgava zo ve'al achat kama v'chama le'oto ish shebekoach hanhagato taram terumat.
We are gathered here in this holy place to give lofty expression and pay our respects to the glowing memory of a peace-loving leader of world affairs who imbued frustrated mankind with a new sense of hope and with aspirations for a serene pursuit of happiness among individuals and among nations. A cabinet member, Religious Affairs Minister Zerhas Barhaftig, added his words, speaking in English for the benefit of the diplomat.
A profound sorrow has descended upon the world, for this bereavement is felt as a loss to all mankind. With the death of the American president, the world has lost a man who was devoted with all his heart to the promotion of world peace and security, to the protection and vitalization of democracy everywhere, and to the safeguarding of freedom for man in his human dignity. His sudden and violent death is felt in Israel with particular grief. We had come to know him as a sincere friend.
And then came a prayer composed especially for this day in the ancient Hebrew tongue.
Zechor et nefesh v'ruach shel ha'ish ha'gadol.
Our Heavenly Father, in thine abundance of love and compassion, remember the soul of the great leader, a man of magnanimous spirit, of deed and determination, the elect of his people, the late President of the United States, who was found by heinous hands at the prime of life, and when his light of leadership and promise shone in its radiant vigor. The entire congregation of Israelis and diplomats, churchmen and rabbis, statesmen and ordinary citizens stood in silence as this prayer was recited at a special memorial service for John Fitzgerald Kennedy here in Jerusalem. This is Alvin Rosenfeld, NBC News, Jerusalem.
The low mass marking the funeral of President Kennedy Day was Catholic. You have just heard a tribute from the Jewish state of Israel. Recently, Dr. Paul Stevens made a sermon on behalf of the Southern Baptist Convention. Here it is.
The religious community of America, including the great family of 10 million Southern Baptists, are weeping tonight, weeping with almost uncontrollable sorrow over this sudden tragedy that struck our beloved nation today. How could it be? How could one so vigorous and dynamic one moment, one who carried the office of the President of the United States on young and capable shoulders, how could he be taken from us so swiftly? None of us can answer these crowding questions, but in the midst of such great sorrow, we must pause to pay tribute to his greatness, no matter what our personal state of mind may be. Our nation has been blessed with great presidents throughout its history. John Fitzgerald Kennedy was no exception. Many Americans, like myself, felt a more than usual identification and pride in President Kennedy, for he was the first of our generation to achieve the presidency. Thus, our sense of loss is intensified. The soil of America has never received the blood of a man who was more dedicated and more courageous. He was a man who bore physical pain and personal loss and political frustration with a dignity that set him apart from all other men. There's some lessons that are to be learned from this great tragedy. One of them is that our dependence as a nation is on certain principles of faith and freedom. Faith in God and freedom of each man. And that these principles bind our teeming millions into a mighty nation. And the fall of one of our chosen leaders will not change our direction of march or our sense of dedication and destiny. As Mr. Kennedy said so many times himself, we must go forward. A second lesson is also apparent. That is that in the midst of life, we're in death. David, the ancient and noble king of Israel, said it this way: death is only a step away. Let the prayers of every American be for Mrs. Kennedy and her family, for our new president and his family. And let these prayers be mingled with earnest prayers for our fellow Americans and for ourselves, that we shall be able to earnestly, honestly pray, "Our Father's God, to Thee, Author of Liberty, to Thee we sing. Long may our land be bright with freedom's holy light. Protect us by thy might, great God, our King."
Catholic ceremony at the funeral. An especially impressive tribute in Israel. And now, an equally impressive sermon from a director of the Southern Baptist Convention. And ladies and gentlemen, we dislike very much the jarring notes that must be inflicted upon our coverage of the day of mourning for President Kennedy. But there is news of transcendental importance it breaks occasionally. We take you now to Russ Ward in Washington.
Morgan, there has been an interesting development here. It occurred a short time ago downtown, and my colleague Ed Goff was at a news conference at a downtown hotel. He's here with us now, and here's the story.
Well, Russ and Morgan, Wagner Carr, the Attorney General of Texas, called a news conference this afternoon at the hotel. It was scheduled for immediately after the burial of President Kennedy. There was much speculation as to what the news might be. The Attorney General's staff had told us nothing of it. The Attorney General did come in, and here is the statement he had to make.
All Texans join with all other Americans in mourning the loss of our president. Because the shocking assassination of President Kennedy, the attempted assassination of Governor Connally, and the subsequent murder of the suspected assassin occurred in Texas. It is my feeling that all the facts surrounding these matters should be made public for the knowledge of all people everywhere. I will therefore, upon my return to Texas, call for a court of inquiry which is authorized under existing Texas law. Those conducting the inquiry will be the top staff of my office, staff, STAFF, of my office, including the Attorney General, working in cooperation with one or more outstanding and eminent jurists and lawyers. Also, top-level local and state authorities will be invited to participate actively, and federal authorities will be asked to cooperate. A full and complete report of the findings of this hearing will be sent to the United States Department.